Welcome to the Autoimmune Connections Podcast. I'm your host, Tammy Anderson of ThrivingPrimallyWellness.com. I'm an adventure enthusiast, a survivor of an autoimmune health crisis, and a certified functional diagnostic nutrition practitioner who helps people who are struggling with chronic health conditions rebuild their health and reclaim their lives. I have created Autoimmune Connections to bring you hope and to empower you to take control of your own health and become the healthiest, happiest version of you. Each week, I will bring you the stories of real people who struggled with long-term chronic health issues or autoimmune conditions, who reclaimed their health and their lives by making changes to their diet and lifestyle after being failed by the conventional medicine sick care model. On occasion, I will bring you experts in the health and wellness space, often people who themselves reclaimed their health and their lives from the brink of disaster by taking their health into their own hands. The content of this show is for general informational purposes only and is not intended to serve as a substitution for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or to treat or cure any illness or medical condition. I will end each episode with a weekly nudge, or in other words, a little nudge of encouragement to try something new that will move you towards improved health. Happy journeys, everyone, and enjoy the show. So I'm going to try to not go into too much fangirl mode with today's guest. For anyone who grew up in the 80s, though, you can compare my excitement about my guest on the show today with getting the opportunity to hang out with Jon Bon Jovi at an after party. But not in the rock star kind of way. You see, I credit Rob's work with literally saving my life when the universe delivered me his first book, The Paleo Solution, back in 2011, and also set me on my current journey of helping others improve their health and quality of life. Rob Wolf is a former research biochemist, health expert, and author of the New York Times bestseller, The Paleo Solution, and his new book, released in 2017, Wired to Eat. He has been a review editor for the Journal of Nutrition and Metabolism and Journal of Evolutionary Health. He serves on the board of director of Specialty Health Medical Clinic in Reno, Nevada, and is a consultant for the Naval Special Warfare Resilience Program. Rob is also a former California State powerlifting champion and gets his sweat on with old guy Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. He lives in Reno, Nevada with his wife Nikki and daughters Zoe and Sagan. Rob, I am so honored to have you on today's show. Thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to join me.
Oh, huge honor to be here. And with a bio that extensive, I feel like I should be taller than 5'9", but this is all we have to work with. So thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And, you know, I really pestered you a lot to get you on the show, and I'm just really so grateful that you gave me the opportunity to have you on.
Well, you're doing great work, and persistence pays off, and I apologize for being slippery. We've been working on a number of projects ourselves. I live on a small permaculture farm, about 3 acres, and for people who do real farming and ranching, they're just going to laugh, but I'm an idiot with this stuff, and so it's a monumental project for me to take on, in addition to having a fairly demanding but awesome Italian wife, 2 kids, and then trying to spin the wheels on my own kind of online presence. Very similar to what you're doing. So I've been pretty hopping, but thank you for being persistent and also patient with my schedule.
No, of course. I totally get it with the farming thing. I have tried off and on with just not totally all on farming like you're doing, but gardening. Mm-hmm. And I have just come to the conclusion that I just simply am not a farmer.
So I just thumb all the way through. Yeah.
I support the local farmers at the farmers market.
Perfect. Smart.
Yeah. So the big goal of this podcast is to deliver folks who are struggling with chronic health issues and autoimmunity hope, and to empower them to realize that they have far more control over their health than modern conventional medicine has led them to believe. So I wanted to start out with a quote from the beginning of your new book, Wired to Eat, where you say, 20 years ago, I was a biochemist working in the areas of cancer and autoimmunity research, and I was sick. So sick due to ulcerative colitis and a number of other niggling problems that I was facing a bowel resection, statins, blood pressure medications, and antidepressants. That was the good part. The darker portion of the story went like this. I thought I was going to die. And the idea was pretty appealing, considering how much my life and health sucked. I was a mess. So many of my listeners may not be familiar with your work or your story. So can we start there 20 years ago when you were sick? And can you paint that picture of your hell for us and tell us how that nightmare set you onto the path that you're on today as an expert in the health and wellness space and where you're moving?
Sure. You know, it's fascinating looking back at all that because I'm literally coming up on 20 years of tinkering with this kind of ancestral health paleo diet template. And at 45 years old, I am far healthier, far more physically vigorous, stronger, the whole ball of wax than what I was in my 20s, my mid-20s. And that was a precipitous crash that I experienced because, like you mentioned in the main intro, I was a former California State powerlifting champion. I was pretty physically fit and active and whatnot. But for a long time, looking back now, I understand that I had some low-grade food intolerances that were a problem, but they weren't debilitating. But then I went through kind of a series of diet and lifestyle changes, one of which was adopting first a vegetarian diet and then ultimately a vegan diet. Now, I'm not saying vegan diets are not efficacious for some people, but for me and that situation, grains and legumes are not a good fit for me in general, particularly as like the base of my food intake. Additionally, I moved to a place called Seattle where there is not this fiery orb in the sky called the sun. And what I've discovered for my own health and sanity is that I need enormous amounts of sunlight and a normal circadian rhythm, like a normal light-dark cycle and whatnot. And that just didn't exist there. I was also embarking on a graduate program in this kind of cancer and autoimmunity research arena. And I thought because I was 20, in my 20s, and because I was eating this vegan diet that I didn't really need to sleep. So I was, at this point, probably racking up probably my third, fourth, fifth year of super underslept, overstressed kind of scenario. And so I want to lay this all out that although this vegan diet was not a good fit for me, and ultimately it was kind of what precipitated this ulcerative colitis crash, I walk around at about 170, 175 pounds, pretty lean, pretty muscular. Right. At this point, my low ebb of health, I was 130 pounds due to malabsorption. Like, I literally could not absorb nutrients. My hair was falling out. My nails were splitting. I had horrible sleep. But I definitely want to emphasize it wasn't just the food. I had this circadian rhythm, this light-dark cycle that was completely disordered. I never saw the sun because I lived in a basement apartment. It was Seattle in the winter. I was at school before the sun came up. I got home after the sun went down. Looking back now, my vitamin D levels were probably barely above what would prevent rickets. I was not sleeping at all. So there were a lot of different factors that went into this, but it cratered my health. My doctors could not believe what a mess I was and what they largely ascribed it to. In doing a good patient intake, they asked me about my family members. And my mom had all kinds of GI problems. Both parents were type 2 diabetics. I was clearly insulin resistant also. Like, I had all the signs and symptoms of that. And so they just kind of threw their hands up and they said, well, kid, bummer of the draw, bad luck, bad genes, good thing you're eating all these grains and legumes in this high-carb diet because otherwise you'd be dead right now,
You just drew the short straw.
Yeah, I just threw the short straw, and that was really all I was left with in surgery and a host of medications that I knew as a biochemist were terrible for me. Like, statins are not a net win. Blood pressure meds are not a net win. And then it was really almost a point of desperation that this idea of an ancestral health way of eating got onto my radar. And I did some research on it. And lo and behold, there were some great papers very early on from people like Lauren Cordain that suggested that these grains and legumes might not be all that great for some people's digestive tract. And some people either genetically or epigenetically may not be that tolerant of that level of carbohydrate. And so I did kind of a crazy thing. I shifted gears and I did what was as far away from this high carb, low fat vegan diet as you could find. And it was basically kind of an Atkins-esque ketogenic diet. And it sounds like some sort of greasy used car salesman pitch to describe it in the following way, but I mean, it literally saved my life. It was like a switch was flipped, and I started sleeping better. I started putting on some muscle again. I actually had normal bowel functions again for the first time in like 5 or 6 years. It's kind of unfortunate. Some people in health and fitness are known for like diamond hard abs and glutes. I'm the poop guy. Like I'm the poop expert. But I became an expert because I was dying from poop-related problems. But I mean, it just changed everything. And I went back to my doctors and I said, hey, look at what's changing. And they're like, wow, that's really cool. And I changed my diet in the following ways. They're like, yeah, I didn't have anything to do with that. And that Atkins diet is going to kill you. You know, this ketogenic diet is going to kill you.
Oh my goodness. You're doing so much better, but the diet's going to kill you.
Yeah, but the diet's going to kill you. And it had nothing to do with the diet. And you know, God bless our healthcare providers. Like, they try to stay as evidence-based as possible. They try to make all their recommendations based off, scientifically proven, vetted elements. But, you know, there's no scientific paper that proves that dropping a hammer on your foot is going to hurt. But there is a point where if you do it 1,000 times and you do it again, it's like, okay, I'm not the smartest tool in the shed, but I recognize when I drop a hammer on my foot, it hurts. And I recognized at that point that when I removed these foods, mainly grains and legumes, I felt way better. When I reintroduced them, I immediately started experiencing these symptoms again. I did this process 4, 5, 6, 10 times, you know, just to, as a scientist, to really kind of kick the tires on this. Am I really experiencing this? And by God, yeah, I was really experiencing it, you know, whether there was a randomized control trial to support this or not. And this is where I think modern medicine has gotten so beholden to the medical reimbursement story that you need to prove in a lab work, evidence-based medicine fashion that, you know, that justify what you're up to. And people don't actually practice medicine anymore. They don't look at the individual across from them and say, well, heck, let's try this. You know, I mean, it's not crazy to try some other dietary regimen, even if it's, maybe a bit divergent from the food guide recommendations and whatnot. And then let's see what happens and be open to the process. And let's let the clinical outcomes drive the boat, not an assumption about the way things should be, but the way things actually are. And, the long and short of all that stuff, I decided to pull the plug on the research story. That was just a slow, onerous process, in my opinion. And it was right around this time that I was poking around online and I found this interesting new workout called CrossFit. And I started talking to the folks that were the founders of CrossFit. And ultimately, I ended up opening the first and fourth CrossFit affiliate gyms in the world, not down the street, which now you could live almost anywhere and have 4, 5, 20 CrossFit gyms around. But myself and Dave Warner opened the first gym in Seattle, and then I had an opportunity to move down to Chico, California, and open what was then the fourth CrossFit affiliate gym. And I got to work with the CrossFit community for almost 10 years talking about this ancestral health paleo diet approach, and really had a pretty massive laboratory to experiment with this stuff. When did low carb work? When did high carb work? You know, and also really learned that all of these other factors, the sleep, the circadian rhythm, stress, gut health, all these things are just as important, and you can't tackle this thing in a parts and pieces approach. During the 20th mm-hmm. century, the name of the game with medicine was dealing with infectious disease, and we did an admirable job dealing with that, but we've done a horrible job dealing with chronic degenerative disease.
Exactly.
And to address chronic degenerative disease, it's a multifactorial problem. That means we need a multifactorial approach. That sounds really complex, but really what it boils down to is we need to sleep more in tune with the cycles of nature. We need to eat foods mm-hmm. that our grandparents would have recognized and not been, you know, shocked by the composition. We need loving, supportive relationships. We need to not live beyond our means financially so that we don't create a bunch of neurotic, crazy stress. And if we tick those boxes, generally things are going to work pretty well. We're going to die eventually from something, but it's probably going to be more likely slipping on the ice skating while we're 90 than it is, succumbing to a 30 or 40 year long slide into the abyss due to degenerative disease.
Oh, exactly. So well said. I always talk about when I'm talking to clients and other people that, you know, I don't know whether I'm going to live to be 50 or 100, but regardless of whatever age I live to, if I live to be 100, I want to be able to get myself on and off the toilet on my own. I want to be able to go hiking if I want to go hiking, go dancing if I want to go hiking, dancing, you know, cook my own meals, be able to have an intelligent conversation. And that all starts with how we treat our bodies now.
Absolutely, yeah. And I kind of look at it a little bit, again, this kind of financial analogy. It's like compound interest. And because we haven't had a financial system that gives us interest in a long time, people have kind of forgotten about it. But, you know, in that compound interest story, if you put a little bit of money in the bank today and you keep putting a little bit more in, it may limit your ability to go out and kick your heels up and whatnot in the short term. But 10 or 20 years down the road, all of a sudden you have an enormous amount of money because of that compounding effect. And we have that same opportunity with our health. That investment on the front end really pays enormous dividends on the back end.
Absolutely. So that leads me into my next question, which is, you know, in your book, several times you bring up the point that when people are working to make improvements to their health, that they really need to identify their big why. Because usually people's primary motivation is aesthetics. I want to lose some weight so I can fit into X size pants or get X size number on that magic box on the bathroom floor. But if health isn't addressed first, they're not likely to succeed long term. And you certainly found your why with your health crisis. I did as well with mine. Can you talk about that concept a little bit?
Yeah, and you know, the why becomes important for that long term buy-in. So almost everybody is able to do something for like 30 days, maybe 60 days. But then the first, you know, family function that pops up, or there's some dodgy food choices, the first time that things get really stressful at work or what have you, then people have a tendency to do one of two things. One, and this is a really dangerous process, is that they deviate from their plan and they have one meal that maybe is different than the basic plan. And then they just throw their arms up and they say, well, I didn't do it perfectly, I failed, and then it's just hookers and cocaine after that. Like, they just go crazy and they abandon all of the success that they've had. And the crazy suggestion that I make in the book with regards to that is that, you know, if we eat three meals a day and we have 7 days in a week, that's 21 meals. And my crazy suggestion is that maybe 18, 19 of those meals are pretty good. They're whole unprocessed foods. They're not crazy. You know, we have whatever variety we have. But then two, maybe three of those meals a week, about 10 to 12% of the meals, kick your heels up, have something else. Now, there's caveats with that. I have serious gluten reactivity. I've had what I believe is rheumatoid arthritis in addition to the gut issues. And so if I kick my heels up, it's something like some keto fudge or some goat milk ice cream or something like that. Cow dairy, I cannot tolerate at all. So I have some caveats. If I want to remain disease-free, then my kicking my heels up might be corn chips or something like that occasionally, because I'm pretty okay with that. If I get a gluten exposure, either accidental or intentional, I'm going to be sick for a long time. So, but there's still so many cool things. You know, dark chocolate covered almonds. You know, cry me a river. Like, is that really, like, really you're going to cry over that versus like having chocolate cake or something? Like, this is the type of stuff that I'm talking about. But, you know, maybe two to three meals a week, you kind of kick your heels up. And if we look at the way that people lived in the 1950s and prior to that, they generally ate this, a protein, a starch, a vegetable at most of their meals. And then on Sundays, they had desserts. If you go to Italy or Greece, this is the way most people eat. And then on the weekends, they have a dessert or two. And what we've turned into our food system now is this thought that every single meal needs to be this like Food Network, Iron Chef level of complexity and just blowing your socks off. And it's just unreasonable. It's ridiculous, right? You know? So that's one part of this story, is that people get too tied into the perfectionism of this whole story. And, the other part is just being gentle with yourself. You know, you're going to have some deviations from the main path, and that's okay. Like, again, unless an individual has really significant health problems, that person will need to be tighter with this story than someone else. And you may feel like you just pulled the short end of the straw again, but another analogy that I make with this is just our relative tolerance to getting a sunburn. If you are of super Northern European lineage, you are probably very light complected, and you will have a lesser degree of sun exposure before you get a burn than like my wife, who is Italian, and like she browns up really well and all that type of stuff. And
lucky
so,
her.
Yeah, lucky her. That's just kind of the reality that we all have. A tolerance to different scenarios. Some people have a higher exercise tolerance. Some people have a higher tolerance to carbohydrates or even some refined foods. And you just kind of have to map that out. You have to play with it and figure out what the cost-benefit story is for you. But if we can learn to appreciate these largely whole unprocessed foods, good meals, but, not over-the-top stuff. And then when we kick our heels up occasionally, it's not a big deal. It just doesn't matter over the long haul. But that's where that why really becomes important, because when you are faced with that challenging moment of, do I just abandon all the work that I've done, or do I recognize that this is just one deviation from what is generally a fantastic process? Things like, I want to see my kids grow up. I want to see grandkids. I don't want to be a burden on my children. I ended up doing diabetic wound care on my father, and I had this knowledge about how to potentially reverse type 2 diabetes and address autoimmune disease. And I couldn't really get my parents to buy in on this stuff. And so they first took my dad's toe, and then all of his toes, and then part of his foot, and then all of his foot. And then eventually he died before we got past he had a below the knee amputation. Mm. And in my dad's head, he was kind of doing this brokering with the universe. He was kind of like, well, if you take my foot, then everything will be okay. And I was like, Dad, it doesn't work that way. It's going to progress along. And so I never want my children to be in a position of either driving me to diabetic wound care or being the primary caregiver doing diabetic wound care on me. It's not going to happen,
Right.
And so those are my whys. And I think everybody can look within and figure out what a really compelling why is, because you will face some moments of doubt and challenge, and you need that really powerful emotion-based why that will carry you through. Our logical part of our brain is really powerful, but it is not the thing that ultimately cements long-term change. And it's that emotive part, and we need to figure out how to get the logical brain and the emotional brain to handshake, almost like a computer modem talking to another computer. We need them to interface, and it's that emotional part that provides a bridge for this long-term behavior change.
Yeah, absolutely. And another thing that you talk about in your book is, you've got to figure out what your trigger foods are, and you talk about how, Nikki makes dark chocolate is gone in a steak of the head with Nikki, but you could, have dark chocolate sitting around for weeks and you wouldn't touch it. But on the flip side, if you had chips or something like that in the house, it's gone in a flash. So you talk about, if you want to be successful long term, and not snack on, junk food or things that are going to set you off your plan, you need to just simply not have those foods in your house.
Right, right. Yeah. I mean, it sounds crazy, but there was a really interesting study that was done where they took folks working in office settings and they provided peanut M&Ms for these folks, which peanut M&Ms tick a lot of boxes. They are salty and crunchy, and they're also sweet, which is why they're so damn good. But they gave people peanut M&Ms, and they provided them in three different locations. The first location was on their desktop, literally a hand's reach away. The next one was they put these peanut M&Ms in a drawer in their desk, so they had to scoot their chair out, open the drawer, reach in, pop it in their mouth, close the drawer, scoot back in. The other one was that they put a big bowl of peanut M&Ms available across the office, but they also said that anybody going towards that peanut M&M bowl was open season for people to haze, and light hazing, not being vicious, but like, hey, Charlie, I see you going there. So when they looked at the amount of peanut M&Ms consumed, the people who just had the peanut M&Ms in the drawer ate half as much as the one that was on the desktop. Just the process of scooting the chair out, pulling that drawer open, reaching down, popping it in your mouth versus just, you know, hand to mouth. It cut the consumption in half. Right. When they put the peanut M&Ms across the room and there was a little bit of social pressure around that thing, it dropped the consumption almost to zero. Typically, what people did was they waited till the end of the day and then everybody made a mad dash for the bowl and they had a few and then they were out. And so, you know, if your strategy is relying on self-control, you are going to fail. You are setting yourself up for failure, guaranteed. And an analogy that I use with this is if you don't want to be mugged, then you don't go to the bad part of town at 2:30 in the morning with a wallet dangling on your head with $100 bills falling out of it. You know, like that is just begging for some nefarious character to come and club you and take your money. And similarly, you know, if you are going to use a strategy of self-control to try to win the hyper palatable food story, you're going to fail. It's just a done deal. And so in our house, we keep some snack options around, but not a ton. And what we've narrowed it down to is it's stuff that's pretty good, but not fantastic. And Nikki will, in fact, give me a bar of dark chocolate. And she's like, go hide this. And when I ask you for a couple of pieces, go grab them for me. And so I'll do that. And some people will be like, oh, that's disordered eating or whatever. And I don't know, maybe it is, maybe it's not. But what happens is that bar lasts a week instead of an hour. And then for me, you know, the sea salt and vinegar potato chips, those come out at holidays and special events. And that's it, because I basically dive headfirst into the bowl and, you know, tackle and armbar people trying to get between me and that bowl, because that salty, crunchy thing is just my gig. And so you need to recognize, to your point, what are those trigger foods, and then just put in some basic, you know, some basic rules and basic guidelines so that you can work within that. If you are, people don't lay in bed at night thinking about pork loin and broccoli. They think about the ice cream in the freezer or the potato chips or whatever. And if you are so jonesing for something that you need to get up out of bed, put on your clothes, hop in the car, drive to the convenience store and get that stuff, okay, fine, do that. But man, that's a hell of a process. Like that is, you know, the analogy of the office worker thing. That's putting the peanut M&Ms down in the boiler room and there's like a barking dog down there that you need to navigate around to get to it. So if we create those speed bumps, then we're just going to be a lot more likely to adhere to things. But then the flip side of that is if you go to a family event or some sort of a Super Bowl party or something like that, and there's something there that you're like, man, I would really like to have some of those chips or something. Again, with the caveat that people with serious autoimmune conditions are going to have some higher standards with this. But beyond that, if you're in a situation where you want to kick your heels up, because again, you're one meal away from getting back on track. It's not that big of a deal. It's not that important, unless you're the person that one exposure flips you. And then it literally is that kind of hookers and cocaine binge for, you know, for days or weeks afterwards. And if you are that person, then you need to have the conversation with yourself about, man, I maybe can't do this at all. Right. There are some alcoholics that can have a drink, but not two. There are some alcoholics that can't have a drink at all. And you just need to be honest about that. And it's not right. It's not wrong. It's the same deal as I'm light complected and my wife is more dark complected. There's different pluses and minuses. If both of my wife and I had to live in a super dark environment, she's going to get rickets before I do. You know, I mean, it's all trade-offs. It's all pluses and minuses. And you just have to figure out what the sweet spot is for you.
Yeah, what really works for you. And sort of, you know, continuing on that line of the conversation, the phrase, everything in moderation, that we hear so often. And I always start off my talks with people, you know, with, have you used this phrase before, everything in moderation? Do you agree with this phrase? And then I lead into, here's why I think it's stupid. that phrase, everything in moderation, is stupid. Can you talk about your take on the everything in moderation statement?
Yeah, and you know, I would actually couch it in a more severe context than stupid. It's a trap.
Yes.
We are trapping ourselves and trapping others using that kind of description. Everything in moderation. Okay. What exactly does that mean? Who defines moderation? Where is moderation? Where does that live? You know, and I mean, when you walk down the snack aisle of the supermarket, on one side you've got salty, crunchy. On the other side you have sweet and savory. The other side is chocolate covered whatever. What does moderation mean there? And when we look around at our society, our usual recommendation has been to eat less and move more. And every day in moderation. Mm-hmm. And we've had 60 years of that idea that we can kind of kick the tires on. And we are seeing exponential increases in type 2 diabetes, obesity. At one time, childhood diabetes meant an autoimmune condition. Now there are kids under the age of 10 with type 2 diabetes. Yeah. This idea of moderation is killing us. We are not genetically wired for moderation. If you look at this kind of ancestral health model, because we lived in a resource-scarce environment, it was a benefit to eat anything that wasn't nailed down because we didn't know if we were going to go hours or days before our next meal. So it made a lot of sense to eat as much of whatever it was that we had available because we just didn't know what the next meal was going to be or when it would happen. But when we can order an unlimited variety of foods to our front door, have it delivered, go from one food to another, moderation, it just doesn't exist. And what I've found mainly is that the people who pull this moderation card, they are inevitably the people who are the biggest cookie monsters. Like they are the person that has like a doomsday bunker of their favorite snacks in the closet and in the basement. And what they're doing is trying to provide a very modest, appealing, unassailable position of, well, you just need to eat modestly. And it's like, well, yeah, that would be great. But we're, in fact, largely incapable of doing that. So what's the next story? What's the actual solution? And that's where, you know, what we were talking about, figuring out the trigger foods and whatnot is the repost state of that. It's the response to that.
Right. And those cookie monsters are oftentimes, you know, they know they need a change, but they're not quite ready to make that change. So really the everything in moderation statement comes from, it's really an excuse because I don't want to make that change that
right.
necessarily changes my health.
Yeah, and there's usually a lot of fear tied into that. There's fear that if they try this and then they fail, they're going to look bad. And so this idea of everything in moderation will, in theory, you know, take the focus off of them and so they can kind of continue doing what they're doing. But, it's a daunting challenge sometimes. And, again, this happens with, like, personal financial goals and a variety of things. People are really afraid to put out there, hey, I'm going to do this, because then they are accountable for it. And you might not make it, or you might not make it the first time. And so that can be kind of daunting. So the everything in moderation story is a great stalling technique to kind of, it's kind of the Jedi mind trick, you know, these are not the droids you're looking for kind of thing. You know, you do a redirection to try to divert focus from what you are up to and make it sound reasonable and balanced and everything. But it's really not. It's a self and other delusional process. And again, it is a trap because in our modern world of foods that are engineered to make us want to overeat them, moderation doesn't exist. It's a fantasy.
Right. And a lot of these folks are also probably people who have tried and been unsuccessful with, quote, diets that were restrictive on calories or fat or both. And, you know, conventional approaches to nutrition that just haven't been working for so many decades. And, you know, they're jaded.
Right, right. And rightfully so. Rightfully so.
Absolutely. So moving on to, you know, this kind of segues into the whole healthy relationship with food statement that you hear so many people using and people talking about cheating, quote, cheating on their diet. You take a really different angle to this in Wired to Eat. Can you talk about that?
Oh man, yeah, and you are hitting all the goodies. This is honestly the best Wired to Eat interview I've had, and I did 100 of them for the book launch. So you are hitting all the really juicy controversial points. Sometimes I almost wish that people don't hit these things. I've had people so angry with me when I suggest that the notion that you need a healthy relationship with food is misplaced, and then you know, this idea that well, what about cheating on your diet? So if you get in and look at the word root of cheating and the history of the word and what it really means, what it means is to gain an unfair advantage against someone and to exploit them effectively. And so when we look at it like that and say, okay, that's what cheating is, that's kind of the definition of it, and then we look at what happens when we deviate from an eating plan that we are trying to embark on, whether it's paleo or vegan or autoimmune or what have you, if I deviate off that plan, how am I gaining an unfair advantage against someone? I'm not. Like, it's ridiculous. You know, there's no nefarious activity. There's no, nothing like that. There's just consequences to that, which if somebody wants to do it, fine. No harm, no foul. But, you know, it's really important to understand that cheating is a really interesting ancient part of our biology. All primates have a profound sense of right and wrong. This is true from, like, monkeys into chimps into gorillas, and all primates, including humans, they really have a tightly tuned sense of what's right and what's wrong within social context. And cheating makes people angry and crazy, and rightfully so, because it creates a lot of drama and conflict. So this notion that you can cheat on your food is misplaced. I would use the controversial term wrong in these days. You can't tell anybody that something's wrong, but so you've got that. But then there's the emotional impact of feeling like we cheated on something. And so it is reasonable for us to feel guilty about exploiting other people because, in this kind of evolutionary biology context, mistreating members of our family or our extended tribe should make us feel bad because that's not going to result in good things. But we have nothing like that occurring with eating a particular food, but we get all of the emotional baggage. And so this notion that you cheat on your food is just incredibly injurious, completely misplaced. There are consequences to food. You eat it, there's a consequence. If we eat, you know, better foods, protein and veggies and seasonal fruits, and, you know, we match our carbohydrate level to how we tolerate those foods, the consequence typically is pretty darn good health. If we deviate from that two or three meals a week of some kick your heels up type foods that maybe aren't, you know, the good protein, veggies and whatnot, then the consequence is that we're probably not going to feel quite as good, and we might have some decreased health or the body composition that we may not be as excited about. But that's it. That is the totality of this idea around, you know, the cheating part. And then the healthy relationship with food, what I've noticed with people who use that terminology, this, again, it's kind of like the everything in moderation. You know, I need a healthy relationship with food. That sounds so reasonable and so enlightened. I mean, it's just, wow, this person is so enlightened. But do we need a healthy relationship with our car or with a door or with a fork? No. I mean, these are tools. These are things that facilitate our lives. And what the focus there, when you start saying, I need a healthy relationship with food, then you're focusing on something that is pretty much unattainable. We're trying to say that we need to somehow come to terms with, you know, like for me, it's like, well, I need to develop a healthy relationship with potato chips because I will eat all the potato chips. And so what does that mean? So I have some in the house, but then when I eat it, then, oh, I don't have a healthy relationship yet. You know, it's ignoring our neuroregulation of appetite. It's ignoring our fundamental biology, but it keeps me distracted focusing on something that is pretty much unachievable. And if there are some math geeks out there, I liken this to trying to calculate the final decimal point of pi. It just goes on and on and on. There's always one more iteration. There's always one more step. And it never actually addresses the fundamental issue, which is, what are your trigger foods? How are you going to address that scenario, and how are you going to set yourself up for success? And so that dual prong of the concept of cheating on your food and then the healthy relationship with food, I take a completely contrarian approach to what you would see out of mainstream medicine and dietetics and most of the media. And the crazy suggestion that I would make with that is we've been hearing that message again for 40, 50 years. Mm-hmm. And I would argue that it's been pretty much a failure. And so maybe, don't want to trigger anybody, don't want to upset anybody, but maybe you can get in and think about perhaps there's some wisdom here that the notion you can't cheat on food. You're not gaining an unfair advantage with people if you decide to eat a bag of potato chips. There's just consequences to it. And then you really don't necessarily need a healthy relationship with food. You need a strategy to be able to make the story work.
Right. And there's no guilt associated with it. There's just consequences, right?
There's just consequences, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think you just said you don't want to push any buttons, but I think that's one of the things that I really like about you is you're putting this information out there and challenging the conventional message that's been going on for so long and making so many people, sick and unhealthy. And not happy inside their bodies. So, I commend you for pissing people off when they need to be pissed off, because you're stimulating thought. And I think that's what needs to happen to inspire change.
Oh, thank you. I don't couch this stuff in some of the things, like there's some fat shaming that goes on and stuff like that. And I am absolutely not in that camp, but I'm also not necessarily, say, like in the fat acceptance camp or the disease identification and acceptance camp. There's almost always something that we could do for anybody to improve their situation, but it usually requires some change, and it may not be immediate. It may not be ultimately everything that we would want, but we absolutely can make the process better. And this gets out in the weeds a little bit, but I'm really kind of a fan of medical history. But there was a guy, Eugene Semmelweis, who was a physician at the mid to late 1800s. And he kind of observed, he was one of the first people to use some numbers to do some epidemiology. And what he determined was that women who had babies on the street, these babies survived at a higher rate than the babies that were born in the hospitals, at a markedly higher rate. Like the infant mortality rate in this mid-Victorian era hospital scene was appalling. And he started looking at, okay, so these women are out, literally they're like homeless in the street giving birth, but the babies live at a higher rate. These women in the hospital setting, their babies are dying. What the heck is going on? And this is before the germ theory of biology was fleshed out. We didn't know about bacteria and viruses. So doctors would routinely go from performing an autopsy, because they were learning about anatomy at this point. Anatomy was kind of a new thing, and doctors were learning about all the structures in the body. They would literally go from an autopsy on a cadaver, go into the delivery room, deliver the baby, and not wash their hands or even wipe them off in between.
Oh, I heard about that.
Now, so he threw out there, he had statistics to kind of support this, and he threw out there may be some sort of an infectious agent that's being transferred from the dead bodies to these babies. And people roasted him at the stake. He literally went crazy, ended up institutionalized. And about 40 years later, the germ theory of biology was developed. We developed microscopes. We could see bacteria. Koch's postulate occurred, where he took a bacteria and inoculated a medium and then sterilized it and re-inoculated it and all this stuff. And now we look back and we just say, oh, well, yeah, of course, this is a quaint story. But there was a 30 or 40 year period there where we had information that was highly suggestive that it could improve the lot of many people. We just flat out ignored it until the information just bludgeoned us over the head and we couldn't really do anything else. What I'm suggesting is that we've had 40, 50, 60 years of eat less, move more, everything in moderation, develop a healthy relationship with food, and it has failed in just about every scenario. And so this is my appeal to folks. Let's not do that again. Let's not repeat what history did with these babies and new mothers. Let's be a little bit brave and take something on, because all that we're asking of people is a change in their worldview. You know, let's look at this from a different perspective. And if you have not achieved what you've wanted for health and body composition and whatnot within this eat less, move more, everything in moderation, healthy relationship with food, can we just try something different and see if we get a different result? And I'm very tickled. The feedback I've had about Wired to Eat is that a lot of people who had suffered for years from a kind of disordered eating and the sense that they were always going to fail, and there were some really deep emotional kind of ties to this whole process, they had never really looked at it from this perspective, and that it's not their fault. You are living exactly the way you're supposed to live. We live in a world of hyper palatable processed foods. They are engineered to make us eat more than what is good for us. It would be silly to do anything else, but we do need a self-defense strategy to be able to navigate that.
Right. And not only are we living in a world with all these hyper palatable foods, but getting into the next part, which is, you know, just living in a way that is counter to the way we are genetically designed to live holistically overall. You know, you talk about sleep and how important sleep is in overall wellness, and exercise and social community and how these pillars of health play a role. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. And, you know, each of those, so the book, it's funny when you go pitch a big New York publisher, I wanted equal weight with the sleep and the community and the movement and everything. And they were like, well, that's all well and good, but diet books are what sell. And so it had to be mainly nutrition focused. And so the bulk of the book is nutrition related. But I could make a really solid argument that the sleep and circadian rhythm, like going to bed when the sun goes down and getting up when the sun comes up and stuff like that, are of equal importance in this overall health story. And when we look at some really interesting studies that look at the social connectivity that people have, folks that have inadequate social connections have a rate of morbidity and mortality, death and illness, on par with a pack-a-day smoker. And, you know, so we're spending all this time focusing on our food, and then we forget that we need healthy, supportive, loving relationships, and it is enormously important. And then this basic idea of movement, you know, nobody likes to exercise, everybody likes to move. And so that again is this, you know, kind of non-negotiable piece of living a really good quality human existence. And a lot of that is just being able to do the stuff that we want to do. If you want to hike, if you want to dance, if you want to play with your kids or grandkids, then these are, you know, maintaining a base level of strength, of endurance, of mobility. This is kind of a non-negotiable piece, and we really need to weave all of it together. And again, it sounds kind of daunting, but you know, we need to, you know, put some focus on our sleep, put some focus on a good quality food, have some people over or attend other folks' houses where we have some, you know, shared meals and some good community time, and then try to figure out how we're going to do the type of activity that makes us happy. Some people do CrossFit. Some people do martial arts. Some people do yoga. The most important exercise or movement program to do is the one that you're going to stick with for the long term. And if we can kind of weave all of those elements together, then we have a really powerful package that, again, you know, we're going to die someday from something, but we're going to have such an incredibly different life experience than what both of my parents had. You know, they lived to 70 and 71, but from their mid-30s on, they were sick, and they weren't particularly vibrant. They didn't hike. They didn't bike. They weren't really able to participate a whole lot with me in a variety of things. And that vector downward was really pretty terrible. And what we understand fairly well is that if people maintain good sleep and some muscle mass and endurance and an eating pattern that supports their activity and in a healthy body weight and whatnot, we tend to get very, very, very old, and then we die. And it's not a long, protracted deal. There's not a lot of expense, not a lot of drama. I'm not excited about dying under any circumstances. But if I had to pick one versus the other, I'll take the live really, really good for a long time and then croak versus a 30 or 40 year slide into the abyss.
Absolutely. And, you know, there are just so many people that are living that way right now in this world. And again, your work is helping to you know, help that, help people in that regard. Going back to community, I always say this, you know, community is so important, and it is those social networks are really lost in our modern world. You know, we lived in these really tight-knit communities for most of our genetic history on this planet. And I always argue that, you know, CrossFit, you know, has become so huge. My argument with, my theory with CrossFit, and one of the reasons that it has become such the sensation that it is that it is a method of creating social networks and community in this modern world where it is largely absent and people don't have those opportunities as much for social interaction. What are your thoughts on that?
I absolutely agree. And, you know, there was a lot of genius that went into CrossFit, but I would argue that this was one of those accidents that you know, spawned this amazing, process. Because when you think about it, the workouts are kind of horrible. Like when you get butterflies in your stomach going to the gym, you're like, oh, I don't know what's going to happen today. You need a pretty compelling anchor for showing up, and that compelling anchor are all the people that you care about and that care about you. But a really well-run CrossFit gym, the coach will talk to you about sleep and circadian rhythm because it's critical to your performance. Usually they are pretty well steeped in some paleo diet or zone diet type stuff. Like that's just kind of what they tend to recommend. It's a gym, so you're going to get exercise. And that community piece is just baked in the cake. It's really the glue that holds it all together. And so the CrossFit type gym, or that mixed modal functional fitness type gym, is one of the only places I can think of where you tick all of these four pillars of health: sleep and circadian rhythm, ancestral eating patterns, a good movement profile, and then you get community as a consequence. And even though I really like things like yoga and martial arts and whatnot, you really end up not getting all of those in a one-stop shop fashion. And right. So CrossFit's interesting. You know, our modern world is, you brought up a really good point. We're really socially fragmented these days, and there's a variety of reasons for it, but some of it is the modern kind of digital economy. It's really cool on the one hand, because if I have a skill set that maybe isn't valuable in Reno, Nevada, it might be valuable in Austin, Texas. And so I can pull up stakes and move and work there. But now I've kind of jettisoned my local connectivity, and I need to rebuild it there. But because we tend to work so much, it's difficult to get that in real life, you know, kind of social interaction going on. We tend to default to social media, and social media is the junk food of social connectivity. It feels like real social connectivity, but it is not. And so it's tough. And then because we're time pressured, you know, how do I go get exercise and then, excuse me, talk about food and get to, you know, address circadian rhythm and also have community? Like you either split that into 10 different hours a week or 1 hour a day, you know, 3 to 5 times a week, like in a CrossFit type gym. And I'm actually working with my jiu-jitsu school to try to get more of the nutrition and some other peripheral movement involved, because it's interesting. Things like yoga and martial arts, when they've talked about nutrition, it's been this very kind of like Eastern religion kind of airy-fairy type stuff, whereas the CrossFit is just very brass tacks. You know, it's like what works, and they implement it. But there are opportunities to go elsewhere to do things. But, man, the CrossFit gym is kind of a cool one-stop shop for all that.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm a member of a CrossFit gym, and I, you know, run a lot of the – I call them healthy living transformations instead of challenges at our gym. But one of the things that we also do at our gym is, you know, we have a question of the day. So people are getting to know each other, and there's this sense of community. People feel this sense of trust.
Oh, that's brilliant. Nice.
Yeah, you know, they can, you know, I feel like if I were to break down on the road at 2:00 in the morning and I put a message out on Facebook, I'm stranded here, somebody come get me, it's going to be one of the members of my tribe at the CrossFit gym.
Right.
So, yeah, that's it's a really cool thing about it. Hey friends, quick interruption to the show to remind you that I will be giving away 2 copies of Rob's new book, Wired to Eat, along with 2 copies of Dr. Terry Wall's new book, The Walls Protocol, Cooking for Life, in an upcoming episode. To be entered to win, all you need to do is give me your feedback on how you're liking the show by leaving me a review on iTunes. Your feedback is really helpful. All you need to do is open my podcast in your podcast app and scroll down the page to the ratings and reviews section and click on write a review. And now back to Rob. Kind of segueing here into autoimmunity. Mm-hmm. So can you talk about the connection between autoimmunity and the gut, and then maybe talk about the cascade effect of gluten on this whole process? Autoimmunity is such a huge and, you know, exponentially growing issue in the world right now.
Yeah, you know, and it's interesting because, again, a lot of people have garnered fame for working with elite athletes and stuff like that. And that's all great. But the thing that's really motivated me is working with folks who are really, really sick. And gastrointestinal issues like ulcerative colitis, IBS, and autoimmune disease has really been my passion. And there are a shocking number of conditions that actually have an autoimmune underpinning. So like narcolepsy, for example, is an autoimmune disease. Vitiligo, where people lose pigmentation in their skin and they get like light patches in their skin, it's an autoimmune disease. There's this thing called porphyria, where the individual goes out in the sun and they get a burn so bad that it burns them down to the periosteum of the bone. It's an autoimmune disease. And we've had success helping people with this. And what we generally do is recommend a gluten-free kind of autoimmune paleo-leaning approach. And there's a lot of different layers of buy-in with this, you know, like do you exclude nightshades? But what's interesting is for ages, people have suggested that there was a connection between gut health and a host of other scenarios. And this has been largely poo-pooed by the mainstream medical scene. But as we've gotten in and dug around this stuff, about 40% of all the known autoimmune conditions have been assessed for do they appear to run in concert with intestinal permeability. And to date, every autoimmune condition that has been looked at for intestinal permeability has in fact shown intestinal permeability. So we haven't looked at all of them yet, but all of them that we have looked at, there's intestinal permeability there. Now, from a scientific perspective, you have to ask the question, is the autoimmunity causing the intestinal permeability, or is the intestinal permeability contributing to the autoimmunity, or are they just happening together, but they're not actually related? You know, and that's a legitimate question. But what we do understand is this autoimmune condition seems to be a situation where the body makes antibodies against proteins in our own tissues, our own cells, and the foods that are oftentimes excluded in like a paleo scenario, dairy, grains, potentially legumes, these foods that are really commonly excluded tend to contain proteins that have pieces that look a lot like the proteins in our body. And so they can irritate the gut. Once the gut is irritated, then these large intact proteins can make their way into the circulation, and they can either individually have antibodies made to them, or they can bind to proteins in our body. And this is where gluten is really interesting. The gliadin protein loosens the tight junctions in the gut and it causes inflammation. And this gliadin protein tends to go into our circulation and then it bonds to a protein that is involved in called tissue transglutaminase. And transglutaminase is involved in virtually every cell in the body. And so we have this gliadin protein attached to transglutaminase. We get an autoimmune reaction. And in some people, that autoimmune reaction can be focused in the gut. In other people, it can be in the nervous system. For some people, it can be in the skin, like a dermatitis herpetiformis. And so you sound like a crazy person when you suggest that gluten can cause problems anywhere in just about anybody. But in fact, gluten can cause problems just about anywhere and just about anybody. And so, you know, again, the crazy suggestion that I and other people have made is that if you have some sort of a known or suspected autoimmune condition, for 30 or 60 days, let's remove some of these foods that are understood to be potentially what I call immunogenic. They can cause an immune type response. People kind of look weird at you if you suggest things like tomatoes might be potentially problematic from an immune standpoint. But interestingly, there's a substance in tomatoes called alpha-tomatin that is used in vaccines as an adjuvant. And what an adjuvant is it enhances the immune response. When we do a vaccine, we want a scenario where the thing that we're trying to be vaccinated against, like the polio virus, we don't want to catch that disease, but we also don't want the immune response to be so low that if we get exposed to the disease, it doesn't really work. And so we use adjuvants to enhance the immune response. So I've seen so many people say, well, tomatoes, that's ridiculous. How could tomatoes be a problem? And a lot of these folks claim to be adept researchers and whatnot, and none of them have pulled up the notion that, oh, well, tomatoes are used in immune modulating scenarios like creating a vaccine. So we have a plausible mechanism here where they could potentially be problematic. Are tomatoes problematic for everybody? Absolutely not. Are tomatoes problematic for everyone with autoimmune disease? Absolutely not. But it's this easy, low-hanging fruit that, you know, to your point, I believe it's diabetes-related issues, cardiovascular-related issues, and then autoimmunity is kind of the third place cause of morbidity and mortality in westernized countries. And it is increasing like crazy. And an interesting sideline with that is now we're looking at diabetes and we're looking at cardiovascular disease and we're looking at neurodegenerative diseases as potentially having an autoimmune component. And so possibly autoimmunity is the cause of all of this stuff if you kind of widen out your perspective and look at it in a proper way. And so it suggests that we may need to address gut health if we have any hope of addressing everything from Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, cardiovascular disease, and then the you know, run-of-the-mill autoimmune conditions like Hashimoto's thyroiditis, lupus, rheumatoid arthritis.
Right. You got to find out what's going on in that gut and address that if you're going to address the underlying autoimmunity. Like you, I throughout my childhood had an entire host of mystery symptoms, and eventually, you know, and I think anybody who, before they have that autoimmune diagnosis, they go through this period of really emotional strife with symptoms that they can't put a hand on, and their doctor, you know, basically tells them that they're crazy, that they're a hypochondriac. I heard that so many times from my parents growing up. Tammy, you're just a hypochondriac. Go to the other room. Right. You talk about the word hypochondriac, and that was really fascinating when you talked about that in Wired to Eat. So tell us about your take on the word hypochondria.
Yeah, it's interesting. Again, you know, I'm kind of a geek with kind of like word roots and where they come from and what the real meaning is. So clearly, as you stated, hypochondria is kind of this basket designation that the person is crazy, their conditions are all in their head, and the hypochondriac classically, like one day their toe hurts and the next day their belly hurts and the next day their head hurts, or, you know, they have some symptoms and it's just moving around and it's all over the place and you can't really pin it down. Well, the hypo means below, and chondria can mean joint or cartilage, but it also means ribs. And so when you really get to the brass tacks of that kind of Latin derivation, hypochondria means kind of the area below the ribs, which is the gut. And now when we look around at the world, and like we just said a moment ago, I suggested that possibly everything from neurodegenerative disease, cardiovascular disease, autoimmune disease may have a gut health component to it. Then this is what's interesting, and I haven't been able to really pin this down. Hypochondria has become kind of this negative designation within medicine, but when it was first minted, was it actually somebody with some deep insight? And they're like, oh yeah, this person who seems to be sick from their toe to their eyebrow it's actually the gut. And so I haven't, you know, either accidentally or on purpose, you know, this denigrative term is actually addressing the situation in a pretty remarkably refined way. It's like, yeah, it is probably gut related.
Right. Yeah. And I think so many people who suffer from chronic health issues and, you know, what I call autoimmune spectrum conditions that, not, you know, haven't necessarily been diagnosed as a specific autoimmune condition, but definitely have all of those components of, you know, on the autoimmune spectrum, they so often end up just, you know, there's this emotional component that they feel like they're making it up and that they're hypochondriacs. So when I come across that part of the book, I was so excited because it really gives validation to those people who are suffering in that way.
And suffering in a real way, and in a way that is sometimes devilishly hard to unpack and fix. You know, for a lot of people, the basic kind of paleo approach is all that they need, and they get some shocking improvements. For other people, they need to step up and do something like an autoimmune paleo or specific carbohydrate diet. And there's quite a number of different iterations on this stuff. And there was just a great paper published where they used an autoimmune paleo approach in ulcerative colitis and irritable bowel syndrome. And it was a pilot study, and they got some remarkable success with this. They didn't have a control arm, but within the participants, there were 15 people that participated. All 15 people completed the program. All of them at the end of the program were asymptomatic for ulcerative colitis, irritable bowel type processes. And they did an endoscopy. There was no disease process at the end of this. So it was really, really interesting, really compelling. But there are folks out there that they have a really complex scenario, and they need more than just a book. They need to work with someone like Chris Kresser or some of these functional medicine folks. And even for these Jedis who are really good at unpacking this whole process, like, we're discovering that there are biofilms in the gut. Some of these biofilms are actually fungal in origin, not bacterial, and that's why standard antibiotics have not addressed it. But, you know, DNA screening and standard gut screening have not been looking at fungal issues. So it's really like peeling an onion, and we're really still only in the outer layers of that onion. And we have some great interventions, again, like autoimmune paleo, ketogenic diet, specific carbohydrate diet, but we're miles away from being able to, like, do a genetic analysis on somebody and say, okay, you need specific carbohydrate diet, you're okay with tomatoes, not with potatoes, definitely avoid gluten. You know, right now we're just in the spot where we have to recommend kind of a shotgun approach, and then clinically just tweak and modify things and try to move towards a favorable endpoint.
Right. And then there's those folks that, like, as you were mentioning, you know, sometimes it's just dietary tweaks that make the difference. But then there are other people who, you know, they probably need to have some functional lab testing done to dig out what some of those underlying causes are that are leading to the dysfunction and address those in another way.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, segueing, you talk at length about personalized nutrition in Wired to Eat. You mentioned a few minutes ago, you used the example of some people can tolerate tomatoes, other people cannot tolerate tomatoes. So what is personalized nutrition? Why is it important? And then how does the paleo diet fit into all of this?
Sure. So I think we've kind of discussed a good bit of the story on personalized nutrition from this kind of immunogenic perspective. So are there certain foods that can irritate or overstimulate the immune system or cause gut permeability? The other side of this is kind of a carbohydrate tolerance story. And there was a fascinating paper that came out of the Weizmann Institute in Israel, man, almost 3 years ago. And I had been thinking about doing a second book for a long time, but I some of the front end of it was all of this, it's not your fault, the healthy relationship with food, excuse me, all that type of stuff. But I didn't really have something that was that different on the back end. And then this Weizmann Institute paper came out, and it was fascinating. They took 800 people, so a really large data set, and they fitted these people with continuous glucose monitors. It's this thing that you slap on the back of your arm, and once a minute, every minute for the duration of the study, it samples your blood glucose. They did a full gut microbiome analysis. They ran extensive blood work. They did a health risk assessment profile on these people. And then they just started feeding them different meals. And what was fascinating is from person to person, the response to a given meal was remarkably different, particularly the carbohydrate content. And even the difference from person to person, there was inter-individual differences. So, like, for example, with me, I might eat sweet potatoes and I eat 50 grams of effective carbohydrate from that sweet potato and my blood sugar barely goes up. I don't get a hypoglycemic crash. I feel fine. Then I do 50 grams of carbohydrate from rice and my blood sugar goes to the moon. I get a hypoglycemic crash. I get vision changes and I have all kinds of problems. And this isn't supposed to happen. There's this thing called the glycemic index and glycemic load, and this was supposed to be true across all people. You know, the lower glycemic foods were supposed to be better for everybody, and the higher glycemic index foods were potentially supposed to be worse. Right. And what the Weizmann Institute research suggested is there are people out there that they eat a big bolus of white rice, and they do great on it. And then they will eat something like lentils, which are super high protein, super high fiber, should be very, very difficult to get a significant blood glucose response off of it, something like lentils. And some of these people had sky-high blood sugars on it. And so it was all over the place. And it really, it shined a light on this, you know, so much of the, you know, we've seen people that benefit from a high-carb diet. We see people that benefit from a low-carb diet. There definitely seems to be, you know, clear differences from person to person, but we've never really had an understanding that, holy smokes, okay, you know, for me and my wife and I did this experiment where we ate the same foods, we tested them, and my wife, just about across the board, had almost a 50% better blood glucose response than I did. And she's 40 pounds lighter than I am. So you would think that, you know, there would be some difference there just because she's smaller than I am. But when we ate white rice, my blood sugar topped out at like 185, 190, something like that. And hers barely got above 110.
Wow.
And we've always known that she's just more carb tolerant than I am. And interestingly, on the flip side of that, we then shifted into a ketogenic diet, and she transitioned straight into ketosis easily. She didn't have any brain fog. There was no keto flu. And I felt like I had just been hit by a baseball bat, you know. And this speaks to having metabolic flexibility that our body should probably be able to shift between protein or carbohydrate and fat as the primary fuel sources. If you can't do that, it's probably a sign that there's some metabolic problems, maybe some mitochondrial damage from anything ranging from like Lyme disease to antibiotics. Like, there's a lot of different reasons. But what we took away from that is there's just a ton of difference from person to person. And I developed at the clinic. I sit on the board of directors of a medical clinic here in Reno, Nevada, and I had the good luck to be able to work with folks and develop this thing called the 7-day carb test. And what we did is we just had them buy a $20 blood glucose monitor, pick 7 types of carbohydrate they want to test every morning at the same time. They would eat 50 grams of effective carbohydrate from these sources and then check their blood glucose at the 2-hour mark. And if it was above 115 nanograms per milliliter, the options were avoid that food or reduce the amount of that food. And then if their blood glucose response was good, then steady as she goes, you know, keep doing what you're doing. And we had some subjective elements to that too, which, how did you feel 4, 5, 6 hours after the meal? Did you get foggy headed? Did you feel hangry? Did you get hungry and angry at the same time? So we had both objective and subjective measures with that, but I've been really tickled. The feedback I've had from folks doing that, it's just been remarkable, because we usually, if we look at some of the immunogenic foods like wheat and corn and rice and soy and stuff like that, and we test that and see if we get some immunogenic responses. And then if we couple that with this blood glucose response, for $20 and a week's worth of practicing our, you know, doing some experimentation, we have a remarkable degree of understanding of what foods and what amounts of foods we do better or worse with. And it's been really pretty popular. People enjoy doing it. Like, I wasn't really sure if people were going to be game for, like, you know, doing the blood glucose monitoring, but people have generally been really excited about that. They like that quantification. The quantified self space is interesting. You know, people track all kinds of different metrics and they wear Fitbits and everything. And I've been super unimpressed with all that because I see people drowning in information and really are given no guidelines for what to do. You just have more information and you don't know what to do with it.
Whereas, oh my gosh, I couldn't agree with you more. And it takes all this adds more to your to-do list. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Whereas this is, it's a set time point intervention. I don't want people monitoring their blood glucose every day all the time unless they're a type 1 diabetic and they kind of need to do that. But I'd like to get people in their body and in intuitively eating, you know. And intuitive eating isn't like, hey, man, that whole cheesecake looks good. I'm going to intuitively eat that. But, you know, in understanding that, wow, I do way better with these foods, not so well with these foods. And then even in that story of, okay, like with white rice, I it's really problematic for me from a blood sugar standpoint. But yesterday I did a 2-hour Brazilian jiu-jitsu session and it was some of the younger guys in there, and man, they try to take a piece of me home with them. And, you know, 5-minute rounds, we did that for 2 hours. It was a lot of work. Like, back of the envelope, I think I expended 1500 calories just doing that.
Wow.
After that event, I went out and I got a 25-gram bolus of rice as with a kind of a Thai food meal. So not a huge bolus, but I ate that post-workout when I had burned a ton of glycogen and my blood sugars were fine. I didn't get that hypoglycemic crash. I didn't have any problems. Now, if I did 100 grams of carbs post-workout, which a lot of people can do, and it's 100 grams of effective carbs is not a lot of rice. But for me, I did a lot of protein, a lot of veggies. I did about 25 grams of carbs from rice. And then when I got home, I had another peach and then a half of an apple. And so my total amount of carbohydrate was about 75 grams post-workout. But some of it was that kind of high glycemic load carb, but I had a pretty small portion. Then I had some slower burning carbs that I know don't really disrupt my blood sugar all that much. And I felt great. And today I'm well recovered. I'm going to go back in and train again today. And so that's been kind of a difference you wanted to weave in the paleo diet. The paleo diet has been this really cool tool for providing some context for people to start with, but it's been kind of ham-handed and that it just says no grains, no legumes, no dairy, whereas some people do fine with these foods. They maybe even thrive on some of these foods. And so in that post-workout period for right now, I seem to do just fine with like a modest amount of rice. It actually is probably beneficial for me, but I need to keep the dose at moderated. The frequency probably needs to be moderated. If I was inactive and then I sat down and ate that rice, it would probably make me feel sick. I wouldn't feel that great from it. So it's kind of a post-workout tool. But in that way, then, I'm able to expand the basic paleo recommendations in some things like rice, or maybe some rice noodles or tapioca noodles or something like that. I could go out and have a bowl of pho in a post-workout scenario, and I just say double meat, half the noodles, and then I maybe eat 2/3 of the noodles, and I'm good. And that's where I've been able to learn how to expand what I'm eating so I get more variety, but at the same time, I'm not making myself sick.
Right. So it's really that N equals one experiment of figuring out what works for your body at the current time.
Yeah. And you know, the way I described it, it sounds like a calculus problem. It's not. It's way easy. Doing it is easier than my description of it.
Right. Right. And one of the questions that I was going to ask you, going back to the experiment that you did with your group with the 7-day carb monitoring, were there any individuals that didn't really have necessarily a spike in their blood sugar response, but still felt like crap after eating a certain food?
Yes. And in these scenarios, we kind of suspect there may be some immunogenic issues. Like again, like rice, a lot of people end up developing a rice allergy. A lot of people develop a corn or a wheat intolerance. And so, yeah, that's why I coupled both the objective piece of the blood glucose monitoring with the subjective element of what's your mental clarity, what's your energy, are you feeling good 4, 5, 6 hours after that meal? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's really about figuring out what works for your body. So this has been a great conversation. I was going to go into a little bit on ketosis and fasting because those are big topics right now. But just in the vein of time, I think that we'll pass on those and let people pick up the book and find out about it reading your book, Wired to Eat. So just two last things. One, we talked before we started recording about a new project that's on the horizon for you. So maybe talk a little bit about that, if you want to go there, and then talk about how people can find you. And I will also include this information in the show notes as well.
Great. Yeah. And actually I'll weave in a little bit of the ketosis stuff too, that's been what we've been working on. Even though I'm kind of the paleo guy, a ketogenic diet is kind of the way I've eaten for almost 20 years. Like I, because of my activity level, I eat a higher amount of carbs than most people do, or what they associate with a ketogenic diet. I'm like 75 to 100 grams of carbs a day, and I kind of cycle in and out of ketosis. But this is my sweet spot between having really good mental clarity, good blood sugar control, but also being able to fuel the kind of physical activity stuff that I do. And so for and 7-8 months, we worked on this thing called the Keto Masterclass, and it's a 13-module program that includes a workbook and all kinds of cool bonus downloads like ketosis and cholesterol and epigenetics, and we talk about intermittent fasting and whatnot in there. So the final chapter of Wired to Eat is a chapter devoted to the ketogenic diet and potentially fasting and intermittent fasting. I think it's an outstanding tool, but it is not a tool that is appropriate for everybody. And so within the Keto Masterclass, like I believe the URL is robwolf.com/KM. There's actually kind of a triage process. And so it will ask you some questions about, are you a CrossFitter? Yes or no. Are you a pregnant or breastfeeding mom? Yes or no. And there are some situations. So like that CrossFit athlete, I found it hard to keto fuel that in a classic way. Like they usually do better 100, 150 grams of carbs a day, for example. Some people with autoimmune conditions seem to do remarkably well with a ketogenic diet. We've been getting a ton of feedback from people who experience Lyme disease, and some of the kind of collateral damage with that seems to be a lifesaver implementing a ketogenic diet. So that's kind of been the project that we've worked on the last 6, 7, 8 months. And again, it's an incredibly comprehensive program, but it's super accessible. It's easy. Like I made it as big and burly as I could, but it's easy to go through. You don't need a biochemistry background to be able to navigate this thing. It gives you all the nuts and bolts to be able to triage where you are, how to implement things, meal plans, the whole nine yards. And again, I guess robwolf.com/KM is where you can track that down.
Awesome. I'm definitely going to check that out.
Cool.
Yeah. So anything else on other places people can find you, or just your website, robwolf.com?
Robwolf.com is kind of the place if you want to track me down. On Twitter, it's @RobWolf. Instagram is @DasRobWolf. I'm on Facebook, a couple of different spots. If you just search for Rob Wolf, RobWolf, you can track me down on Facebook. And probably a third of my day is devoted to answering questions on social media. I don't look at this stuff as a popularity contest. I am here to serve people. And so I devote a significant amount of my day to being accessible and trying to help people in a real interactive way. I try not to create a firewall between myself and the folks that need help. This is really my For me, my legacy story, like the more people I can help, then the more valuable my life was. And so I take all that stuff seriously and try to help as many people as I can.
That's amazing. One of the reasons I love you, Rob, you're so accessible and your mission is really clear.
Well, thank you.
So my very last thing is on this podcast, I have included a weekly nudge. So each week I either have my guest or I myself give some sort of piece of advice or one little challenge to my listeners on something that they can do right now today to start improving their health and quality of life. So if you could give my listeners a nudge on that, what would it be?
Oh, man, it would be get out in the sun as early as you can every day. And I know this is hard. It's getting more difficult for me. I live in Reno, Nevada. It's very sunny, but the days are getting kind of chilly. And so the other day I went and sat in my shorts with no shirt, got some good sun. Like the UV index was like 4, but it was 38 degrees. So it was kind of chilly. But, you know, so long as the wind didn't blow, I was okay. But I would just really encourage folks to get outside, get as much sun on your body as you can. Clearly don't cook yourself into a leather handbag, but we tend to get far too little intense sunlight during the day, far too much intense artificial light in the evening and beyond. And so if we could really pay attention to that circadian rhythm and our exposure to sunlight and minimizing our evening sun exposure. Oh, and you know what? Buy some blue blocker glasses. The price ranges from like $6 to $9 on Amazon all the way up to $150. Just find one that has a great review and get it. But in the evening, when that sun goes down, turn your lights down, put on the blue blockers, and you will fall asleep better. You will rest better. It enhances melatonin production. The blue and green wavelengths of light that we get exposed to, both from the sun and artificial light, suppress melatonin production. And that is where circadian disruption occurs. And, you know, there was just a fascinating study. I know I'm jabbering on and we're supposed to be wrapping up.
That's okay. This is all good.
Sleep disturbance is like a 98% correlate with the onset of Alzheimer's disease. Now, Alzheimer's has been called type 3 diabetes, diabetes of the brain. But what's interesting is disordered or short sleep makes you intensely insulin resistant. So although the food is definitely a factor, I could probably go out on a limb and suggest that our circadian dysregulation, our altered sleep-wake cycles are probably the real main culprit. And we can clearly tweak some levers using a lower-carb approach to eating, but we really, 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 the low-hanging fruit is get outside, get sun on your skin, and then in the evenings, put on some blue blocker glasses, turn your lights down. If you have to use some sort of technology, enact the, things like night shift or f.lux and stuff like that so that we pull that blue and green wavelength of light out of our exposure. And what you'll find is that you fall asleep earlier, you sleep better, you wake up more refreshed, and then we don't lose our marbles from Alzheimer's disease.
That's awesome. I have the blue light blockers. I have the Swannies, which I absolutely love.
And they're amazing.
Gosh, I go back and forth on my habit of wearing them consistently. You've given me new motivation to make sure I'm wearing those every day, every night.
Commit to 30 days. And here's something to do. Set up a jar, and every day that you don't do it, you have to put $10 in the jar, and then that jar will be delivered to the political party that you hate.
Oh, that's a good one.
Oh, people, after the last political cycle, I don't think anybody will fail this one. So this is the sleep your way through politics challenge. So you have to wear them in the evening. If you forget, $10 goes in the jar. End of the month, you have to deliver that jar to your local political party that is on the opposite side of the fence from you.
I love it. That is a great way to end. Rob, thank you so, so much for joining me. This has been an incredible conversation. I think it's going to add so much value to my listeners and just hopefully we'll change a life or two.
Awesome. So a huge honor spending some time with you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for tuning in to the Autoimmune Connections podcast. Because I am truly grateful and honored to have you as my listener, I will be doing a giveaway at the start of episode 9. Two lucky winners will receive a copy of Rob Wolf's new book, Wired to Eat, and two winners will receive a copy of Dr. Terry Walls' amazing new cookbook, The Walls Protocol, Cooking for Life. To enter this giveaway, I am asking you to do two things. One, leave me a review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast site you're listening on. I look forward to hearing your feedback. Your reviews really do help and will help me achieve my goal of making it to the top of the charts and make a new and noteworthy section on iTunes. This, in turn, will help me reach and impact more people who are suffering from chronic health conditions or autoimmune diseases. And two, visit my website, thrivingprimarywellness.com, and leave me your email to claim your free gift of a comprehensive, color-coded food list that I have developed that you can use to get started on improving your health right away, and also so that I can update you on upcoming podcast episodes and blogs, and where you can find some links to some of my favorite things. Finally, you can find links to all of the weekly shows on my website, thrivingprimarywellness.com. Thanks again for listening, and I'll see you next week.